Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you this lovely Sunday. Today we've got a show with someone who's been much requested by our listenership over the past several years, one of the great experts on the Middle East and the Muslim world. Our guest will be Juan Cole of JuanCole.com, the professor from the University of Michigan. We'll be talking about everything you'll want to know about what's going on there now and what Americans ought to know. So join us today, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Hundreds of people will meet in Durham, North Carolina on Saturday, March 7th for the second in a series of town hall meetings on the future of the Internet in the United States. The meeting, organized by InternetForEveryone.org, is a chance for everyday citizens to talk about the impacts of the digital divide and how to close it. Tens of millions of Americans live without high-speed Internet nationwide, and in North Carolina, nearly 5 million people don't have a broadband connection. Megan Tatey of Free Press spoke to people across the state about the importance of Internet access.
Brian Baudet didn't think he would have a problem telecommuting when he bought a house in the mountains of Madison County in western North Carolina with his wife and three kids. But Brian, a software engineer, was in for digital culture shock. High-speed Internet isn't available in his area. To keep his job, Brian has subscribed to expensive satellite Internet, but even that connection can be unreliable. Brian suddenly found himself on the wrong side of the digital divide.
Unfortunately, it's affected me in various ways, including a job I had at the beginning of the year. They were a dispersed company throughout the country. There was no home office, and it was a great job. Unfortunately, after 6 months, I realized I wasn't really working out because of my satellite situation. My broadband was too slow, and it really affected my job performance.
Brian says not having broadband puts him at a competitive disadvantage.
We could move in town, and we could sell our house and try to do that route, but with the economy and the housing market as it is, it's that's a tough call. So I'm a little concerned that my lack of options in broadband will force me to follow those options.
Brian isn't alone. Too many people can't apply for jobs, attend online classes, start home-based businesses, and participate in the global economy because broadband isn't available where they live or it's simply too expensive. Wally Bowen, director of the nonprofit Mountain Area Information Network in Asheville, North Carolina, says many people with broadband aren't even aware that a digital divide still exists.
I think one of the frustrating things for me, being an activist in this world, is going to places like Washington, D.C., or conferences in Minneapolis or St. Louis or wherever, and telling people that, you know, there are people in this world who are still on dial-up, and why? I mean, it's like some sort of moral failure or some sort of ignorance about, you know Why don't they use broadband? Well, you don't understand where people live in rural areas. Many of them don't have access to high-speed Internet. And it's, once you have high-speed, you just think, well, everybody has high-speed. And so this has been a real struggle to communicate that so many of our fellow citizens have been, left behind.
Yet as half of the country is left behind, it's becoming increasingly clear that a connected nation is the key to revitalizing the economy and rescuing local communities. Tim Will, executive director of Foothills Connect Business and Technology Center in Rutherford, says North Carolina has been hard hit by the vanishing textile industry. With the jobless rate climbing, Tim says the opportunities from broadband, which is sparse in the county, could breathe new life into the community.
If you don't have broadband, you're not going to get economic development. If you don't have access to broadband, obviously no company is going to move into your area because they're going to demand broadband.
Ironically, the United States, the birthplace of the Internet, has fallen far behind other countries in terms of broadband speed, deployment, and cost. The economic stimulus bill just signed into law by President Obama allocates $7.2 billion for broadband expansion. But that's just a piece of the much larger puzzle to bring the benefits of the internet to all Americans. Brian Baudet hopes the funds will help connect his community because the consequences without broadband are dire.
Now, you end up with almost a class-based system where you have people that have information and people that don't. People that can get things done in a fast and reliable way and people that can't.
To see more profiles about the digital divide in North Carolina and across the country, visit internetforeveryone.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is Juan Cole, professor at the University of Michigan and the author of the blog JuanCole.com, which has become probably, if not the leading authoritative source for people wanting to understand the Muslim world in the Middle East, on the short list in the first tier of websites and media that will qualify for that designation. Juan Cole, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
You know, for starters, let's talk a little bit about your website, which is where I learned about you a couple years ago, friends saying you've just got to read the site if you want to really get an understanding of what's taking place over there. When did you start JuanCole.com, and how much time does it take you to do?
Well, I began the website in the spring of 2002 as a direct result of September 11th. It was a place, initially, that I could archive my email messages. I was on listserv discussion groups and so forth about what Al-Qaeda was, what the implications of the September 11th attacks were, and was bringing to bear my own decade of living in the Middle East and my study of modern Muslim movements. My emails were fairly popular, but people started asking me for back copies, and that's a hassle. So I started archiving them at the blog, and then after a while it became a medium in its own right.
And it's extensive. I mean, how much? It seems like you're writing fairly serious pieces almost on a daily basis.
Yes. Some days I simply link to other people's articles. It's called parsing or news consolidation in the trade, which isn't very time-consuming. But occasionally I'll write my own essays. I worked as a journalist or translator for a newspaper in Beirut in my youth, my job was to get Arabic wire service reports and put them over into English in inverted pyramid form with the most important things first. So I did that for a year, and it gave me good habits of mind. So I can turn out an essay, and it looks like it takes longer than it does. I'm a fast typist. I'm a fast reader. I'm near native fluent in the languages I use. It looks like it took me all day, but it'll be an hour or two.
You know, in some ways, I think, Juan Cole, the success of your website is, I don't want you to take this the wrong way because it's meant as a compliment to you, but it's also a criticism of the weakness of our conventional news media's coverage of the Middle East that I think it's fair to say that most Americans could consume our standard news media like good citizens and still be generally confused about that part of the world.
Well, yes. I mean, mass media, television, you know, really is sound bites. It doesn't allow, the form of it doesn't allow for an in-depth report. And blogging allows a person to do is, to put things in context. And to try to make them understandable. And if people have the patience to read it, it can be illuminating.
You know, I had Robert Fisk on my show, the English correspondent, 2 years ago perhaps. And he told a very interesting story. He said that when he's in the Middle East and he's reporting, he'll oftentimes be in hotel bars with American reporters. And on a bar stool, these guys had brilliant insights, understood the situation on the ground fairly well oftentimes. But he'd read their articles, and they were flat and tepid, and really he'd learn nothing. And he would ask them, you know, how come you're so smart last night after two drinks? And your articles seem to be so bland. And they would say, this is what we consider journalism in the United States. And he was always perplexed by that. And does blogging allow a person maybe to get past the boundaries of the professional system, the way it's practiced in the United States?
Well, there are two parts of journalism as American journalists tend to practice it. One is news gathering, and the reporting of one's news gathering is supposed to be done in a even-handed tone with the presentation of relevant facts from across the ideological spectrum. And then there's commentary, and commentary is well recognized to be to be pointed and to be personal and to be, you know, biased ideologically in the direction that the journalist or the commentator is. And so, in other journalistic traditions, and to some extent, I suppose, some of the British newspapers and the French don't necessarily agree with that way of dividing things up, but my blog only very seldom involves actually news gathering. I'm mainly reading news, which has been gathered by others and reported, and then putting my commentary on it, whether it's an analytical commentary or a polemic commentary. I'm on the commentary side of things.
Do you think, but following up on this point, do you think, Hwang Cole, that the U.S. print media, because television, as you've already said, specializes in sound bites for the most part, but the print media that cover the Middle East, do you think that in the news gathering part of their work, they do a fairly effective job of covering the full range of positions and opinion without sort of putting a thumb on the scale towards, say, the U.S. position?
Well, I think that the scene is sufficiently diverse that it's difficult for me to generalize across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, what bias is often difficult to put your finger on in the first place, because even the selection of which stories to do can be biased. And I find that U.S. journalism is U.S. journalism. It tends to wave the flag. And there are journalists and there are even companies which are more what I would think of as critical of the standard story coming out of Washington. I think the McClatchy, which used to be Knight Ridder, and their journalists are investigative journalists. You know, they won't take the whatever the White House press secretary or the Pentagon spokesman says that day and make it the lead.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the journalists do tend to follow Washington's line. You know, I notice that and to be fair, you know, Washington knows how to manipulate them. So it's been argued by the University of Maryland journalism analysis unit that you know, in American journalism, we have this form where you're supposed to put the most important thing first in the article, and the second most important thing, and then any background you put at the very end. And the White House knows this, and of course, in the American system, if the president said something about some event, then it would be the most important thing that day. And so the Bush White House was very good at making sure that if a story was breaking, Bush delivered a soundbite, and that would go in the first paragraph. And it allowed them to control the slant of the news. So with regard to Iraq, I think typically the Bush administration really only had two speeds. It was progress and slow progress. So you'd have an absolute disaster, you know, a bomb go off and kill 200 people, and the Bush people would come out and say, well, you know, we're having slower progress in Iraq than we would like. And I very seldom saw that kind of language challenge. You know, it would go in the first paragraph.
Our guest today, Hwang Cole, the professor of Middle East history at the University of Michigan, also the author of or proprietor of HwangCole.com, which as a regular commentary on Middle East politics and the Muslim world. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a couple weeks before we're going on air, just before the Israeli elections. So please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let Juan Cole and myself, Bob McChesney, do the yakking. Juan Cole also has a new book coming out in March of this year, Engaging the Muslim World, published by Palgrave Macmillan. It is a book, I gather, that is advice for the incoming Obama administration. I suspect advice for all of us for how to understand better the Muslim world. Professor Cole, what are some of the errors that Americans make, including our leading politicians, or problems we have in understanding the Muslim world so we can engage with it effectively?
Well, I think that the threat assessment is often unrealistic. Obviously, Iraq was an irritant. Saddam's Iraq was an irritant to U.S. policy. But it wasn't a threat to the U.S. mainland, and it was configured as a threat. That was the basis for the war. I think a similar exaggeration is often carried out with regard to Iran. You know, Iran's per capita spending on defense, on military matters, is less than any other Gulf country, with the exception of the United Arab Emirates. And yet, in our press, Iran is, you know, depicted as this behemoth that's growing in stature and power, and as a threat to U.S. interests. But when you look at what they actually have in the way of military equipment, it's pretty primitive.
And what about al-Qaeda and terrorism? How deep are the roots of al-Qaeda in the Muslim world? I think to many Americans who maybe don't consume a great deal of news, or maybe some who do, there's a sense that this is an overwhelming force, that that young Muslims are turning to al-Qaeda, turning to terrorism as a matter of course. How prominent a phenomenon is this?
Well, it's changed over time. I mean, al-Qaeda is a small terrorist organization. It's not widespread, and the people who actively would be involved in it are a very tiny number. I mean, it's more like, it seems to me, the gun nuts of the United States, the Timothy McVeighs and so forth, than anything else. So it's a fringe. And it can, in opinion polls, sometimes get, you know, fair percentages of people saying they support it. But if you look closely at those polls, people actually are saying that they support opposition to U.S. dominance of their lives, of the Middle East. So I was amused by a poll that was done in Saudi Arabia, was released about a year ago, which found that 87% of Saudis thought that fighting terrorism and crushing al-Qaeda should be the number one priority of the Saudi government. And then you had about 10% of Saudis who said they thought well of al-Qaeda. But if you did an analysis of the various questions asked, of that 10%, 90% of them said that fighting terrorism should be the number one priority of the Saudi government. So the al-Qaeda supporters are very worried about terrorism. And what that indicates to me is that when they said that they supported al-Qaeda, they're the kinds of people who deny, you know, that it was behind 9/11. And they think of it just as the organization that got the Soviets out of Afghanistan and, you know, kind of freedom fighters for Muslim causes. So the support for actual terrorism in the Muslim world is low. Now, some struggles that the Americans would, that the American public might construe as involving terrorism, are seen by the Muslim world as national liberation movements, and that's just, you know, a difference of perception that's always going to be there in violent conflicts. So, the U.S. public was all for the Mujahideen, what Ronald Reagan called the freedom fighters. Shooting down Soviet officers in Afghanistan. And the Soviets considered that terrorism, but the Americans considered it freedom fighting. So So there are going to be situations like that where there's just a difference of perception as to what value to put on the violent act.
Juan Cole, during the presidential election, one of the most striking scenes took place, I think, in John McCain's last town hall meeting, I believe in Minnesota, when a woman stood up and said, you know, this Obama guy, I think, you know, he's a Muslim. And candidate McCain said, well, you know, he's not a Muslim. I can tell you he's a good family man. And what was striking to me, among other things, was that comment did not get much criticism. The suggestion that being a Muslim was antithetical to being a good person and a family man. And I think it sort of spoke to the notion that a lot of Americans have, that a great suspicion of the Muslim religion and people who are Muslims. And the idea that Muslim faith leads invariably to very dubious, anti-humane, anti-democratic, even terrorist activities. What do Americans need to know about Muslim religion and faith and culture that they don't know?
Well, if you live in the region, what you find is people are people. Muslim culture is oppressively family-oriented. It's, you know, the warp and woof of people's lives is family. The sociologists find that most people are married who are of a certain age. They use the technical term, they talk about ever married, which is that they're married, or if they get divorced, they marry again. So family is central to their lives. And obviously their family values are a little puritanical from an American point of view. They're very intolerant of sleeping around and hanky-panky of various sorts, and the Muslim religion forbids alcohol, so nightclub kind of life wouldn't be viewed positively. But which does not mean to say that in a big metropolis like Cairo there aren't nightclubs or hanky-panky, but in the smaller towns or villages, it's a pretty conservative atmosphere. So, you know, I think it's not so different in that regard from small town America.
What about the idea, Professor Cole, even more, I think, more important to some extent, or more central to the politics of the United States, that a lot of Americans hold that, you know, Islam is simply incapable of producing a secular democratic society, that it will be overridden by the sort of biases of its religious values?
Well, I know that the charge is often made by critics of the Muslim world that it's incapable of producing a secular democratic society. But I don't entirely understand the charge, to tell you the truth, because, is it being said that Western Christianity was capable of producing a secular society? And was that what Western Christianity was aiming at? I mean, if a secular society rose in the West, it was over the objections of Christianity. And as far as I can tell, the Vatican regularly fulminates against this development. Obviously, a religious tradition is not going to produce a secular society, and I don't understand why anybody would think that it would. If the question is, you know, are the peoples who are of Muslim heritage capable of adopting a secular society, then, yes. I mean, it happened in Soviet Central Asia. Uzbekistan couldn't be more secular, and it happened in Kemalist Turkey, where Mustafa Kemal Ataturk adopted secularism. It's often said, well, yes, that's not an organic development. It's under Western influence, and it's imposed from above. But then much secularism in the West was imposed from above, as with the French Revolution. So I have to tell you that particular meme just doesn't seem to me to be analytically very clear. I mean, what is exactly being alleged? And moreover, it seems to confuse the people who say that, whom you're quoting, seem to confuse secularism with dem- democracy, which are not the same thing, and lots of religious societies are democratic, and Muslim societies have demonstrated an ability to practice democracy. Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country, democratized in the late 90s, the same time as Taiwan did, and so far at least have a thriving democratic scene.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Juan Cole, the professor of Middle East history at the University of Michigan, the proprietor, lead author, sole author of the JuanCole.com website, Informed Comment. Just go to JuanCole.com and read it. Really one of the authoritative places to go to make sense of what's going on throughout the Middle East and the Muslim world. Today's program is being recorded a couple of weeks before going on air, so please don't call in today. Please keep that in mind as we make our comments, that they're 2 weeks before airtime. Sit back, relax, enjoy the show. Juan Cole is also the author of the brand new book coming out in March this coming month, Engaging the Muslim World, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And this is a book, I take it, Professor Cole, which is intended to suggest to the new Obama administration ways to improve U.S. foreign policy towards the region. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, let's, on that note, talk about some of the real hot spots in the region that I suspect are engaged in your book, starting first and foremost, of course, with Iraq. And Iraq is a major news story in the United States, yet I think it's still, in a lot of ways, very confusing to Americans what's going on there. And making sense of it is extraordinarily difficult. Where do matters stand in Iraq today, and what, in your view, are the options facing the Obama administration?
Yes, well, Iraq in the past few years, since the U.S. Overthrew the Saddam Hussein regime, has been involved in a brutal and devastating civil war, mainly between Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims. The big news, which, as far as I can tell, the U.S. Commentators tend to miss, is that under U.S. auspices, and sometimes without entirely meaning for it to happen, the Shiites won the civil war. And the big scene of the civil war was the capital, Baghdad, which is a city of some 6 million people, from which hundreds of thousands, nearly a million probably, Sunni Arabs have been ethnically cleansed. They have been chased out to other parts of Iraq or to Syria and Jordan. So Baghdad was probably, on the order of 50-50 Sunni-Shiite in 2003 when the U.S. arrived. Given the recent provincial election results from Baghdad province, I would say it's no more than 10-15% Sunni now. And so the Shiites have taken the capital. They have taken power at the federal level and at a majority of the provinces. So that's over with, and the Sunni Arabs have been defeated, and many of them seem to recognize it. But there is another looming ethno-religious struggle, which is now between the Arabs and the Kurds in the north, and that's a story that our media has told us very little about. It is the one, I think, that is most dangerous to the Obama administration.
Can I, before you go any further, for the sake of listeners and myself, roughly what percentage of the Iraqi population is Kurd, Shia, and Sunni? And also, the Shia and Sunni, I mean, what is the nature of the split there? Because we hear those terms without much explanation oftentimes in our media. Are these religious differences such that these are people who just can't tolerate each other ever? Or, I mean, are they like Baptist and Methodist, or are they, more fundamentally opposed?
Right. Well, with regard to the second part about Sunni and Shia, the differences between the two are not that great. They put, and I suppose you could compare them to the differences between American Protestants and Catholics. And in 20th century Iraqi history, they very seldom fought with each other on religious bases. you almost never would pick up a newspaper in the 1950s and 60s and say, you know, Sunni Shiite riot in Karbala. It was very uncommon. So it was the fall of the Ba'athist regime that created a political vacuum, and entrepreneurial politicians used religious identity as a way of whipping up political fervor and getting their people in place. But it's a new thing. It's one of the problems that historians have with some journalistic discourse. Journalists often don't know much history, and they tend to think about struggles that are dominating the newspapers today as age old. And they did this in the Balkans, when the Bosnians and the Serbians were fighting. But we historians don't find that most of these struggles are age old. In fact, we find that people can learn to hate and deploy violence against each other on the basis of some ethnic marker of identity, you know, within a year or two. It just is, it's like a tsunami. It just comes suddenly, and it doesn't necessarily have strong historical roots.
And what is the proportion of the Iraqi population that falls into Shia, Sunni, and Kurd?
Right. Well, that's disputed, but my best guess is 60% Shiite, 17% Sunni, and 20% Kurd. And there are other things, so mm-hmm. It comes to 100.
And Saddam Hussein had been a Sunni?
Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, and he was a secular Sunni Arab nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
The Ba'ath Party was, you know, disproportionately Sunni at the top, probably instead of 20% of positions, it had over 50%, and the percentage rose as you went up in the government. But it had a lot of Shiite middle managers as well. The Ba'ath Party was an Arab nationalist party that didn't make religious adherence, you know, the only judge of someone's aspirations in the party. And so of the 52 that Ba'athist, high Ba'athist officials that the Bush administration was trying to capture, nearly 20 were Shiite.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today, Hwang Kol. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't try to call in. Hwang Kol, of course, the professor of Middle East history at the University of Michigan, author of the forthcoming book, be out just in a couple weeks, Engaging the Muslim World, published by Palgrave Macmillan. We're talking about Middle East politics today, and we're talking right now about Iraq. So for the Obama administration, is there any way out that is palatable to the United States?
Well, I would argue that there is, and that one of the big problems so far has been that the Bush administration, which invaded Iraq, was peculiarly unengaged and declined to intervene in key events. The U.S. personnel on the ground in Iraq, who were most often excellent at their jobs, I heard back from them that they were just extremely frustrated and fit to be tied, that George W. Bush just seemed unwilling and uninterested in providing leadership on Iraqi affairs. And so things just were allowed to drift for the most part, that began to change towards the end of Bush's second term. But I don't understand, for instance, since we know that the Kurds in the north, who are mostly Sunni Muslims, but they don't speak Arabic at home. Their language is an Indo-European language, is actually related to English. So the Kurdish population has three provinces as a kind of provincial confederacy. You can kind of think of them as being like Quebec in Canada. Their province has certain prerogatives,
mm-hmm.
and is a special position within a federal system. But they want to add a fourth province, the province of Kirkuk, which is an oil center, and which has a mixed population of Kurds, Arabs, and yet another group, the Turkmen, who are related to the Turks of Turkey. And the Arabs and the Turkmen, for the most part, don't want to be dragooned into the Kurdish Confederacy. And so there's violence about all this. And before the U.S. withdraws, I'm hoping that the Obama administration will get the parties together and make a political settlement instead of just withdrawing, and then, you know, there could be a war over Kirkuk between the Arabs and the Kurds. And they've already been shooting at each other.
Do you think the United States can be out of Iraq with its military forces within 16 months, as the president during the campaign was promising?
Well, I think it can be out of Iraq in something like that amount of time. That is to say, I think it would be a mistake to insist on a number that was given out during the presidential campaign. But I think that a couple years is what we're talking about, is plausible for a drawdown of the combat troops. You know, luckily, we have relatively few military casualties now in Iraq, the United States. We have, you know, you will see in the newspapers, if you look carefully, from time to time, a soldier is still killed by a roadside bomb. Or sniping, and there are woundings, but it's always a tragedy when that happens. But it's compared to the past, it's a relatively small. And that statistic suggests to me that mostly U.S. Soldiers and Marines are not engaged in a lot of heavy hand-to-hand combat anymore, that many of those tasks are now being increasingly done by Iraqi military and security forces. And so the likelihood is that, you know, a lot of the U.S. support on the ground will become increasingly unnecessary as the Iraqi military becomes better at its job, better equipped, better trained, and they are undergoing ongoing training and are getting better equipment. The Iraqi government, because of the high oil prices last year, is rich with reserves and can afford to buy tanks and armored vehicles and so forth. So the one thing that the Iraqi military does not have, and which it won't have for years, is an air force and air capability. And since in any military operation against militias, close air support is an important part of the operation, I think the U.S. will be in a position of having to provide some air support to the Iraqi military for 5 or more years. The Iraqis have put in orders for helicopter gunships and so forth, which won't even arrive until 2013.
Our guest, Juan Cole. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This show is pre-recorded, so please sit back, relax, enjoy the show. Juan Cole, of course, professor of Middle East history at the University of Michigan, the proprietor of the Informed Comment on JuanCole.com, and author of the forthcoming book, Engaging the Muslim World, published by Palgrave Macmillan. You've been writing a lot on your blog, Juan Cole, about Afghanistan. And during the presidential campaign, President Obama loudly proclaimed that this is where the action was, that we took our eye off the ball, as the saying goes, by getting involved with Iraq, and we should have stayed in Afghanistan. And in effect, what needed to be done in Afghanistan was to have a surge there, to transfer the military might that had been used and inappropriately in Iraq and use it appropriately in Afghanistan. What is your take on that position, and where do we stand with Afghanistan, and how easy would that policy be to implement?
Well, the criticism I have of the discourse around Afghanistan that the Obama campaign used is that it's a moralistic discourse, that Iraq hadn't actually attacked the United States, and it was wrong for the U.S. simply to fall upon it. In a a war of choice. Whereas the U.S. was attacked by Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan, and therefore overthrowing the Taliban, destroying Al-Qaeda, and building up a new and stronger Afghan government that would be an ally of the West is a morally right thing to do. It is supported in international law that the U.S. should do that, whereas the Iraq War was illegal. And while all that may be true, the fact of the matter is that Afghanistan is probably an insoluble morass, and that throwing all the resources of the Pentagon at it is not necessarily going to result in a good outcome.
As you note, I think on your blog, and I've seen elsewhere, the sort of the nickname for Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. And this is a place where empires going back to ancient times have fought and lost almost invariably in that region. Is there a danger to the Obama administration that this could become, you know, Obama's Vietnam, were he to go in there, and any sort of huge increase of military operations?
Well, I think that is a danger, and I've written so in Salon.com. What is the goal here? What is it that we're trying to accomplish in Afghanistan? If it is to wipe out the Taliban, well, the Taliban are a social movement that have a certain amount of support in the Pashtun areas, and wiping them out would be a genocide. Very unlikely to be accomplished, and very brutal if it were done. If the goal is to establish a stable Afghan government that could itself deal with challenges like that of the remaining Taliban, that's state building on a large scale. Afghanistan is a mess. It's been through 30 years of war. There's still millions of landmines around. It has no visible means of support. It's a fourth world country. Its annual gross domestic product is on the order of $9 billion a year. $9 billion a year is almost nothing. Some small businesses in the United States would have that. The whole of Afghanistan it doesn't produce much income. And the taxes on it that the central government receives are small. And, the kind of army that Afghanistan would need to deal with Afghanistan, because it is a country, population-wise, around the size of Iraq, but area-wise, it's bigger and more rugged. And it has the Himalaya Mountains, it has deserts, and so forth. So the military that you might need to actually control all that territory would be, 100 or 200,000 troops, and it's estimated that they would cost, $1 billion to $2 billion a year, and the government doesn't have that kind of money. Where would you get it? You'd have to have continual international aid flowing in. There's a real question as to whether Afghanistan actually has the resources to erect a strong enough state to accomplish the work the U.S. wants it to do.
Whenever the talk goes to Afghanistan, it's a short leap to start talking about Pakistan, the next-door neighbor. And Pakistan, of course, is an enormous country, population-wise, and has nuclear weapons, and also is somewhat, politically from afar, looking at our news media, it doesn't seem like necessarily the most stable country in the world. What is your take on Pakistan, and what would you advise President Obama to do were he to ask you with regard to Pakistani policy?
Right. Well, Pakistan is a complex country. It's got four major ethnic provinces. As you say, it has a long history since 1947 of governments that alternate between elected civilian governments and military coups. The U.S. has tended to support the coups, and I think that has stunted Pakistani democracy because a grassroots party grows over time. It has canvassers and it has an organization, and if it keeps being interrupted by coups and people are put in jail or not allowed to campaign, it weakens that structure. So the first thing to say is that the U.S. should stop supporting the coups. And President Obama has, in fact, praised Pakistan's return last August and September to a civilian government. The military dictator who had made the coup of 1991, Pervez Musharraf, was forced out by a popular movement and by the parliamentary elections of February 2008. And the new parliament threatened to impeach him, and so he was forced to step down. So there was a kind of revolution in Pakistan last year of a democratic sort, and you would think this would be hailed by the American commentators, because isn't that what the Bush administration kept saying would be a good thing?
As long as our guys win the elections.
Well, yes. See, that's the problem, is that Musharraf was considered by Bush his guy. And so the removal of the dictator was not welcome in Washington. It was a piece of hypocrisy. The people who came to power in Pakistan are left of center and relatively secular, and have fair relations with the United States, but they're not Washington's guys.
Mm-hmm.
When you say left of center, that was already in the Bush administration a bad word. It's a good outcome.
Center was a bad word, too.
I'm sorry?
Center was a bad word, too.
Yeah, right. So it's a good outcome, I think, both for the Pakistani people and for the American public, that a major Muslim country has returned to democracy and that a relatively secular government came to power. The crew that came to power, unfortunately, are notoriously corrupt. And the new president, Asif Ali Zardari, the husband of slain former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, was known as Mr. 10% when the Bhuttos were in power. He is said to have gotten a cut of foreign contracts. And I've had Pakistanis remonstrate with me that no, 10% is a way understatement. There are problems there, but nevertheless, it is a popularly elected government. It does have grassroots in the form of the Pakistan People's Party and its rival, the Muslim League, this democratic movement. And other countries have been corrupt and survived it. I think there was a certain amount of corruption in the United States recently. South Korea was notoriously corrupt in the 80s, and yet nevertheless moved towards democracy. So I think there's potential there in Pakistan. It has a big now urban white-collar middle class. It has a lot of people invested in a rule of law. As you say, it's a big country, 160 million. It's growing rapidly in that regard. So it has enormous potential. It's not, the Western perception of Pakistan tends to be that it's full of religious fanatics.
Definitely. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, most Pakistanis, in my experience, are traditional Muslims. They go to saints' shrines for intercession. They like Sufi music. The film Dead Man Walking had Pakistani spirituals in the background, basically. Then a certain number of urban Pakistanis are more or less secular people. And there's been a big debate within Pakistan as to whether it is a country for Muslims, in which case also for secular Muslims, or whether it's an Islamic state, as the Muslim, the political Islam would like. But, the Muslim political parties, kind of the Pakistani religious right, did very, very poorly in the parliamentary elections in February of 2008, and it was more secular-minded people that came to the fore. So it's not the case that it's a country full of religious fanatics, and God knows there are religious fanatics there. But the big issue is the northwest frontier and the federally administrated tribal areas, which a very vague and inaccurate analogy could be made to American Indian reservations. There are tribal peoples in the Northwest, in very rugged, craggy territory, who have never been under the control, really, of any central government. The British were there 100 years, and it just got worse and worse. Winston Churchill could not put down the tribes of that area. And the Pakistani government doesn't really control that area either. But it's a small area. You know, it's the size of New Hampshire with a population of about 3.5 million. So Pakistan as a whole is, you know, the size of California, Oregon, and Washington State put together, with a population of 160 million. So being afraid that the tribal areas will take over Pakistan is silly. I mean, it's like being afraid that the Navajo will take over Washington. Yes?
Well, that's, you know, let's just, we only unfortunately have a few minutes left. I'm so engaged with what you're talking about. A couple of points I do want to get to. First and foremost, the world economic downturn, which I see the International Monetary Fund just recently termed a depression. How will that affect this region, and how might that affect the politics of the region?
Well, the economic downturn in the world is bad for exports. So, you know, Pakistan, for instance, was beginning to have some success with exporting light textiles. And those orders are going to fall off. On the other hand, it is also exports food, and I think people are still going to need to eat. So the impact is negative. A lot of governments in the Middle East are suffering. Turkey, you know, I just heard from a friend who works for a newspaper who's been laid off. Egypt depends very heavily on tourism. It's going to suffer. So certainly the Muslim world, the Middle East, is going to be caught up in this world economic downturn just like everybody else. I think, however, that the impact of it is going to be sufficiently different in each country to make it difficult to generalize about the impact. Lebanon, for instance, has been very careful in its banking practices, and so has been virtually unaffected, as I understand it. And there is a fall in oil prices because of less demand in the economic bad times, but OPEC is organizing to try to cut production, which would put the price back up a bit. And that will help some of the countries in the region to get through this. So it is a danger point. It should be kept an eye on, but generalizing about it is pretty difficult.
Our guest is Juan Cole, the professor at the University of Michigan of Middle Eastern History, and also the proprietor of Informed Comment at juancole.com, where he writes regularly on Muslim world, Middle Eastern politics. I urge people to go there. As you can tell from this past 50 minutes or so, there's a lot to learn. There's so much we haven't talked about yet. We've only got about 5 minutes left, Professor Cole. And I do want to talk about Israel and Palestine. We're taping this just before the Israeli election, so obviously you can't talk about the exact moment there now with any authority when this program airs in a couple of weeks. But if you could just give some general, I guess what I'd like for you to do, if you would, is tell Americans, in your view, what they don't really understand about that conflict. What's missing in sort of the American discourse about Israel-Palestine?
Well, I, to tell you the truth, I don't think most Americans understand the condition of the Palestinians. The Palestinians were displaced by the 1948 war. Many of them expelled deliberately to Lebanon or Jordan. Others fled in refuge to the West Bank or Gaza. And in 1967, as a result of that war, the Six-Day War, the Israelis occupied the West Bank and Gaza and sort of came after a lot of the refugees and ruled that area and are the occupying power. They control the air, the water, the ground, the borders, and people's lives are very deeply affected by Israeli occupation. And they're stateless. The ones in the West Bank and Gaza have no state. They have no citizenship. Being stateless in the modern world is kind of like being a slave in the time the U.S. Constitution was formed. You're three-fifths of a person. There are all kinds of rights you don't have. People can do things to you, take away your property and so forth, with impunity. So I find that the American public just generally does not know that the Palestinians are living under Israeli occupation or how bad the conditions of the occupation are. And the concentration is, and this is entirely legitimate, on Palestinian violence against Israelis, but that the context of that violence, and I'm not excusing it, violence is bad, but the context of that violence is not understood. Yes?
Well, during the 2000 presidential election, there was a telling moment in the debate between Al Gore and George W. Bush when they were talking about foreign policy in the Middle East, and presidential candidate Gore said, the United States has to be an arbiter between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They has to seek to be the judge and bring about a lasting peace. And then almost before he had exhaled and inhaled for the next sentence, he shot out, but of course we will always support the Israelis completely, no matter what. And it struck me that that really sort of captured the absurdity of the U.S. position. What exactly is the U.S. role there? How important is U.S. support, for example, to the ability of the Israelis to maintain this occupation?
Well, absolutely central. And, the question is, how do you help Israel? If you want to support it, is it really doing Israel any favors to keep it locked in this unfruitful situation where it's occupying 3.5 million Palestinians, who increasingly are being turned by the occupation into a kind of lawless Somalia? I mean, is that really going to be good for Israel in the long term? And so the hope in the 90s was that there could be a two-state solution, that the West Bank and Gaza could be the basis for a rump Palestinian state that, would give people citizenship and have a economic advance and give them the basic, decent, dignified human lives. And that two-state solution now is increasingly implausible because the Israelis doubled their settlements on the West Bank after the Oslo Accord began. And the West Bank now is carved up into cantons by Israeli superhighways that the Palestinians can't get across, by checkpoints. It takes 8 hours to go between villages that used to take half an hour to go between. They can't get to Jerusalem. So it's increasingly looking like, the cantons that South Africa set up in the apartheid era. And it is turning into a kind of apartheid. And with regard to Gaza, the Israelis have it blockaded. They don't let in even enough food. 15% of children are malnourished. I mean, it is impossible that this situation should go on like this. And now that the two-state solution is increasingly not plausible, what's going to happen? You can't just keep the Palestinians forever in this condition of statelessness and economic depression, 50% unemployment. Lives are millions of people are being ruined by this situation, and it's not good for Israel. You can see the ways in which the occupation is turning the country increasingly to the far right. You have Israeli politicians openly talking about ethnically cleansing Palestinians. And, if this kind of talk were engaged in by any European country, we would consider it a form of neo-fascism.
Unfortunately, on that quite stunning comment, Professor Cole, I see our time has run out. I want to thank Juan Cole so much for joining us today on Media Matters. Thank you, sir, for your participation in our program.
Thank you so much for having me on, Bob.
Juan Cole is the professor at the University of Michigan, the proprietor of JuanCole.com, and author of the forthcoming Engaging the Muslim World, to be published in March of this year by Palgrave. I'm Bob McChesney. See you all in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today mostly sunny skies with a high of 30 degrees. Tonight should be breezy and cold with a low of 10 degrees. Monday, sunny skies with a high of 34. And Monday night, mostly clear with a low of 18 degrees. Tuesday should bring mostly sunny skies with a high of 42. This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a broadcast service of the College of Media at Illinois.